The following is a special encore presentation for the 4th of July weekend of Brainstorming with Billy the Brain on AM 1400 KKZZ.
Genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turn now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for Brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
And we're going to start off today with Carol Burnett is going to be my first guest in the first half hour. We will feature guests of this caliber throughout the coming weeks and months ahead. Brainstorming with Billy the Brain is going to be NPR with one difference. I categorize Brainstorming with Billy the Brain as NPR done right, with the emphasis on the right. NPR stories are typically slanted to the left, and I'm a little bit right of center when it comes to political beliefs. I'm a fiscal conservative. Government needs to live by the same economic rules as the rest of us. Prudent spending, balanced budget, minimal services. Socially, I'm less conservative. I approach each social issue on a case-by-case basis. For instance, I interviewed Mike Farrell a couple of weeks ago about the death penalty. Turns out we're both on the same side of the issue against the death penalty, but for vastly different reasons. Mike's against it for humanitarian reasons, which I think is very, very noble. I'm against it for far more pragmatic reasons. I think it costs too much to put a prisoner to death than it does to incarcerate him for life because of the endless appeals and legal wrangling. So we both end up on the same side of the issue, but for different reasons. You may not always agree with what my guests have to say or what I have to say. That's okay. I defend the First Right Amendment to think and say anything you want, no matter how wrong you might be. In fact, I invite differing opinions. This is a call-in show. You can reach us by calling 639-0008. That's 639-0008. Call me. Tell me what you think about the show. Tell me what you think about life, what's going on in the world, about whatever's on your mind. I'll always honor your opinion, and occasionally I'll challenge you, too. Every edition of Brainstorming will have a theme. Something that ties the entire show together and gives it relevance for Ventura County. Sometimes the theme will be serious. Other times it'll be fun and frivolous. In all cases, however, the theme will be pertinent to what's going on here in Ventura County. All right, so let's look at today's show as an example. Okay, our guests are Carol Burnett and Kathy Kinney, who played Mimi on The Drew Carey Show. What theme unifies these two guests? Well, first, they're both famous from television. They're both comedians. Both TV shows impacted the culture in this country. Carol Burnett's show influenced the culture, and Kathy's show sort of reflected it. So what sets these women apart, however, is that they're both kick-ass women with an important message to share. Carol reflects on how she said her power, let's say that again, Carol kind of reflects on how she found her power in show business and what it took to become a success. Kathy shares what she learned to help other women find the queen inside of them. Both subjects, I think, will be very interesting to our listeners. In addition to show themes, each show will have a segment at the bottom of the hour called Celebrating America. In this segment, I will read a quote from a famous American that captures an idea or a concept relevant to today. Stay tuned for today's Celebrating America at 10:30. It should be fun. Brainstorming is uniquely Ventura County. In addition to guests who interest Ventura residents, we'll also have the local traffic and weather. We'll have giveaways. In fact, we'll have our first giveaway right at the top of the show for our first caller who calls at 639-0008. We have a family dinner package from Red Brick Pizza. Red Brick Pizza is located at 4990 Telephone Road in Ventura. That's in the Barnes & Noble Plaza, the intersection of Telephone Road and East Main Street in Ventura. Now, inside of the package of the family packed dinner, we have a large pizza, two toppings, chopped salad, Parmesan breadsticks, and a large gelato for anybody who calls in at 639-0008. 639-0008, they can win the large family pack dinner. All right, Carol Burnett's going to join us in a minute. Before she does, I just want to take a moment and comment on what's going on in the world, probably the most pressing social issue that's out there is the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico right now. BP is going to try a more dramatic attempt to cap the oil well and to siphon off some of the oil that is spilling out into the ocean, and now the natural gas that is also spilling out into the ocean. And a lot of people have come down hard on British Petroleum about the way that they have approached and tried to solve this problem. No question about it, the folks at BP could probably have done a much, much better job of communicating. But when it comes right down to it, to put a cap on all oil exploration in this country while we try to solve this problem is probably not very pragmatic, and it's going to set us back for a number of months, if not years, when it comes to refining and producing our own oil and gasoline. And here's why. I mean, it's not an easy fix for what's going on. Drilling is a dangerous business. Drilling is also a business that requires risks. And unfortunately, this is a calculated risk, and accidents do happen when it comes to drilling. It's unfortunate, but they do. The reality is, though, unless you want to stop driving your car and start walking to work and live and work in your local community, you're going to have to accept the fact that we are an oil-dependent country. We get much of our oil from outside of the United States, and anything that we can produce inside the United States only helps to benefit us. But how does that all relate back to Ventura County? Many of you that are old enough will remember that prior to the Gulf disaster, the worst offshore oil experience that was ever happened right here in Santa Barbara, Ventura Counties, 1969, the blowout in the Santa Barbara Channel, which sent millions of gallons of oil flooding to our beaches and everything else. Now, some 30, 40 years later, of course, nobody remembers the fact that we had the blowout and that the oil spilled onto the ground. The reality is we need the oil. We need to continue to do that. Libby Gibson. Libby, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Libby. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good.
Well, thank you for calling in, and thank you for listening to Brainstorming. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well.
Good. You listening for Carol Burnett? Are you listening for Kathy Kinney? Or
I am listening for Carol Burnett, and I heard on that this is your first day for your first show.
It is. Well, thank you. Yeah. We're celebrating by having some fantastic guests on this week, and among them is Carol Burnett. Now, what did you like most about the Carol Burnett show?
Oh, just everything. Everybody she had on it, Tim Conway and Harvey Korman. I mean, they were just so hysterical. I grew up with them. I mean, it's pretty much, you know, and I loved her little wink at the end. And
how about the little tug on the ear?
Yes, the tug on the ear, the wink and the tug.
We'll discuss what the wink and the tug were all about while she's on as well.
It was about her aunt or something.
Close, very, very close. It was about her grandmother who raised her. Grandmother who raised her. So that's great. Libby, congratulations. You're the winner of the pizza from Red Brick Pizza over at 4990 Telephone Road. You're in a nearby neighborhood, so you'll be able to drop in and pick up your complete family dinner anytime that you like.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, Libby. And thanks for calling and listen to our show.
Okay.
All right, great.
Take care. Bye.
So we were talking about the oil spill as we're waiting for Carol Burnett to join us, and she'll join us here in just a minute. Carol, by the way, has written a new book. It's entitled This Time Together, Laughter and Reflection, and we'll be talking about her book. I found that she's written two books. This is the second of her two books, and I found that this book was the more interesting of the two for me. First book was more of personal reflections on her early life. This book, which is called This Time Together, really talks more about her the life that we all know, the life on the show. So now, without any further ado, we've got Carol Burnett on the show. Those of you who don't know, every so often we get privileged to have a true legend appear on this show, and today is one of those days. I define a legend as somebody who has made a profound impact on business, art, culture, or lifestyle. My next guest has impacted all of these areas and more. It's impossible to overestimate the impact that she's had on musical variety and television during her 11 years on CBS. She was the first woman to have a musical variety show. She assembled one of the greatest ensembles of comedians in TV history. She influenced millions of Americans weekly with her unique grace and style. Carol Burnett is an American actress, comedian, singer, dancer, and now author. Carol had started her career in New York. After becoming a hit on Broadway in Once Upon a Mattress, she debuted on television, and she successfully appeared on The Gary Moore Show. Carol moved out to Los Angeles and began an 11-year run as a host of The Carol Burnett Show, which aired on CBS from 1967 to 1978. The Carol Burnett Show was a variety show combining comedy sketches, song, and dance. If you want to call in and speak to Carol, the number here is 639-0008, 639-0008. Carol, how are you today?
Hey, Bill, how are you?
Well, I am doing terrific. Thank you so much for being my first guest today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for all the nice things you said. I just have to make one little correction.
And what was that?
Well, Dinah Shore was the first woman to have an hourly music show.
Ah, all right.
Ours was a musical comedy variety show.
All right, thank you for that correction.
It was a little bit different.
But you bring up an interesting point. All right, Dinah Shore was the first, and look at how easily I forgot Dinah. Gary Moore, which was the first musical variety show that you actually appeared on, was a leader in that area.
And he was.
Tell me, why is it that we don't remember who Gary Moore was or anything about his show?
I have a feeling that, you know, the timing, whatever, wasn't quite right. And also possibly the fact that it was in black and white.
Now, why would black and white make a difference today?
Well, because people, you know, if they want to watch a rerun or some, you know, like they have on TV Land and so forth, the music stuff, if they do any musical stuff or musical comedy or variety, is usually in color.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, but what a lot of the shows of Gary's might have just been destroyed.
That might be it.
Thinking about storing classics or anything, you know, a lot of times it was on this old thing called Kinescope.
Yes.
Where he would do the show and then it would be shown in California. He'd do the show in New York and it'd be shown in California by way of Kinescope. And those things don't last. And then, you know, we didn't have the technology then or the smarts. You know, to say, let's save these things.
Right.
You know, a lot of wonderful movies, most big screen motion pictures have been destroyed.
Sadly
studios
true.
Who, yes.
Sadly true.
Terribly sad.
It is. It's a shame. Now, let's stick on the Gary Moore theme. I'm reading your book, and by the way, I loved your book, This Time Together. Read it from cover to cover.
Oh, thank you.
The full title is This Time Together, Laughter and Reflection by Carol Burnett. Clearly, in my mind, there are two heroes in your book, This Time Together. Gary Moore was one of them, and your former husband, the late Joe Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
Why were these two men so important in your life?
Well, Gary gave me, he just believed in me and gave me my first start. And Joe at the time was a producer of the Gary Moore Show. He was an associate producer to Bob Banner.
Mm-hmm.
And they had come from the Dinah Shore Show.
Ah.
They'd been wooed away by CBS to move back to New York and do Gary's show. And so Joe had great taste, and he had a great way with working with people. And so that, yes, definitely that helped tremendously. You know, and I was not one who would ever, even in my own show, and I think I put this in the book, I was too chicken, because in those days, you know, if a woman spoke up, it was that she was considered
uppity. There's another word, but we can't use it.
Yeah,
that's
whereas
right.
If Jackie Gleason or Sid Caesar or Milton Berle or any of them spoke up and said, well, this sketch isn't working, they would say, this stinks, and go fix it.
Uh-huh.
I could never do that. I could never do that.
But
because you know, it just wasn't at that time a thing that women did.
And I'm glad you caveated by saying at that time, because
right.
Clearly your role helped to change all of that for future generations. So I think that is cool, very cool.
Thank you.
Now, in your book, you know, it struck me as your book was sort of like the question and answers that you did before every show.
Exactly.
And in fact, you sort of, I won't say stole, but you borrowed that concept. So where did you learn the whole question and answers to warm up the audience, and why was it effective for you?
Well, when I was doing Gary's show, Gary never wanted, usually, you know, when an audience is coming in and so forth and before the show starts to tape, they would send out a comedian, a stand-up comedian, to tell jokes to warm up the audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get them in a laughing mode, hopefully. But then Gary always thought, well, you know, I don't really want that, because what if the guy is funnier than the show? I mean, that was, he laughed about that, but then he said, you know, I'm just going to go out and warm him up. So Gary would go out, but it wouldn't be taped. They didn't think to tape it. And do Q&A with the audience. And I remember backstage, you know, waiting before we were going to go on the air, listening to how he connected with everybody. I mean, it was always charming, and he had a beautiful way with words and with answering questions and just making the audience love him, you know, because what was there not to love? He was such a good guy. And so then years later, when I was going to do my show, Bob Banner, who was the first producer, and Joe, again, was associate producer, he said, why don't you go out and do some questions and answers and warm up the audience? And I said, I don't know how to do that. I've never done that. He said, no, it would really be good, Carol, for you to go out there and so that folks get to know you, Carol, before you start putting on those bright wigs and crazy outfits and teeth blacked out and jumping out of windows, you know.
I know, and it turned out to be very effective
and
for you.
It did, and I was at first really scared. The first show that we did it, I've been quoted as saying this, I was terrified that nobody would raise their hands, and then I was terrified if somebody would.
That they would, yeah.
Yeah, and after about the first 3 or 4 weeks when we were on the air, the studio audiences, who would then come to see a taping, knew that's what we were going to do, so they kind of came prepared with questions.
Oh, and you've got some doozies in your book. I'm not going to steal any thunder.
Oh, there's some wonderful ones.
There are. And the book is titled This Time Together. We're talking to one of the legends, Carol Burnett. We're glad to have her on the show. Carol, before you dialed in, Libby Gibson, one of our regular listeners, she had a question. I'm sure you've been asked this question before, but it has to do with the ending of the show, the tug of the ear.
Yeah.
Would you mind relaying to everybody what that signifies?
Well, when I got my first television appearance, when I first went back to New York, and I was just fresh out of dropping out of UCLA to go back there, I remember I got a job on the Paul Winchell Kitty TV show, which had the dummies.
Right, you know, right. Winchell Mahoney time, yeah.
Winchell Mahoney. And so I called my grandmother, and it was was a live show from New York, again, with the kinescope feed to California, where my grandmother was. And I called her, and I said, Nanny, I'm going to be on television tomorrow morning. And she said, what are you doing? And I told her. And she said, well, say hello to me. And I said, Nanny, they're not going to let me say hello to you. You know, it's all scripted and everything, and I can't just, like, say, hi, Nanny. You know, it's not my show. And so we worked out this signal of pulling my ear, which meant, hi, Nanny, I love you, you know, and everything's fine. And then later on it meant, hi, Nanny, I love you, everything's fine, and your check's on the way. That was after I started to make a little bit of money on Gary's show.
I see.
But I always pulled my ear for her, even after she died, all that time. And I still do it. If I'm on a show, I'll find some way to kind of just reach up and scratch my ear.
No, that's
and,
wonderful.
You know, and so it's not always in the same place, but like it was when I did my show.
But that's very heartwarming. We're talking to Carol Burnett, everybody. And, Carol, I just want to shotgun some names at you. Reading your book was like reading a book of who's who, the people that you've interacted with over the years. But I've got to start with the cast. Vicki Lawrence, yeah. Harvey Korman, Lyle Wagner, and Tim Conway. Tim, by the way, is a resident of Ventura County. I know you know that,
right.
But our other listeners might not know that.
Right.
So just give us a rundown on each of your co-stars there, Vicki, Harvey, Lyle, and Tim.
Well, Vicki was a raw diamond. And she was only about 18, and she had written me a fan letter, and I was drawn to it. You know, I thought, this is, I don't know what it was. Something told me that she was kind of special.
Did she remind you of you?
Totally, because we were also looking for, we were thinking of doing a sketch when we were going on the air called Carol and Sis, and it would be Harvey, and it's kind of a little quasi-sitcom in the middle of the variety hour. And Harvey and I would be married, and we're raising our kids' sisters. So she sent me this letter. She also sent me a picture And I thought, oh, my gosh, that's me at 18, you know. And then she said she was going to be in a contest for Miss Fireball of Inglewood. Miss Fireball of Inglewood. And it was a little newspaper clipping that she included. And I looked at the date, and the letter I was reading right then in front of me, Miss Fireball contest was this very night. Because the letter came about 3 weeks late through CBS.
Okay.
So my husband was coming downstairs to kind of relax, and I said, don't get too relaxed. We're going to go see the Miss Fireball contest.
Which I'm sure he was thrilled about.
Oh, he said, what? I told him. But I had called Vicki. They listed her father's name in the paper, and I got her number through the operator. And just to ask her if it would be okay with her if we came. I didn't want to make her nervous. And she said, sure, you know. So that's how I met Vicki, and we auditioned her that fall.
Hmm.
And this was around Christmas time when I got the letter, and we auditioned her and another girl. And Vicki, again, was raw, but she had that X quality, I call it.
Yeah,
you know,
the
where you
the just
it
know
factor. In there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Harvey, we had seen on the Danny Kaye show, he was Danny's sidekick. That was, by the way, a wonderful comedy review.
Yes, it was. A lot of people have forgotten Danny Kaye over the years,
exactly.
But he was a great comedian.
I thought that was a great show.
Mm.
And he was going off the air, and we were coming on the air, and we kept saying, we need somebody like Harvey Korman. You know, and then, wow, duh, the penny dropped. We said, why don't we ask the Harvey Korman? And we did. We called his agent. And then I remember one afternoon I was walking towards my car in CBS Television City, and Harvey was going towards his, and we kind of knew each other just, you know, by passing each other in the hallways and stuff. And we waved and smiled, and I swear, no, I think I attacked him. I might have bent him over the hood of a car. I'm not sure. But I said, please, please, Harvey, you've got to do our show. Please, please, please. You know, it was not the best way to ask somebody to be on your show. But anyway, that happened.
It proved effective.
That's right. And then Lyle, we wanted kind of like a hunk, you know, for me to fawn over.
And he was handsome.
And he was very handsome. But then we kind of changed that attitude after a while, because I realized, wait a minute, I'm a mother. I'm much more mature than I was when I used to Google eye all the good-looking guests on the Gary Moore show, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so Lyle turned out to be a very good sketch player. And so we put him in a lot of sketches. You know, as opposed to his coming out and introducing everybody and then me falling into his arms in a faint. And we just stopped doing that. And so Lyle really turned out to be a very good sketch player.
Oh, good. And what about Ventura's own Tim Conway?
Oh, Ventura's own Tim. There's nobody like that one. Nobody. He is fearless in his comedy. And he was on our show as a guest first. And then we started booking him quite often, like almost every other week or twice a month, you know.
Sure.
And then, again, duh, the penny dropped. And finally, people think he was on every show for the full 11 years. He signed on as a regular weekly performer in the ninth year.
Wow.
Yeah.
How about that? You're right. I would have guessed he was on much earlier than that.
Absolutely.
Sure.
And he's just, he's as nice a human being as he is funny.
That's quite a compliment.
It is a great compliment to him, and he deserves every accolade that he gets. He is he's a kind person. He's enormously talented and has this great comedic mind that, you know, he saved many a sketch on our show. We never knew what he was going to do.
Which made him brilliant.
Made us crazy. I used to say, because sometimes he would do things that he hadn't done in rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be dying. We'd be trying not to laugh.
Well, that was sort of an earmark of the show. You guys were cracking up half of the time.
Well, that was Tim's fault.
Oh, it's blame it on Tim.
I'm going to blame it on Tim. And it was his goal in life, I think, to destroy our beloved Harvey. He would just do this. Sometimes they'd start, as we always call them, the Harvey and Tim sketches. And all Tim would have to do was enter the scene and just kind of look up at Harvey and cock his head a little bit to one side. And yes. Harvey would be gone.
Oh, my.
He would be totally gone, anticipating what was going to come next.
Sure.
And not knowing, you know. And Harvey prided himself on being a consummate actor, which he was, and great comedic chops and all of that. And he used to get so mad at himself. None of us ever wanted to break up because that would be fake. But at times we just couldn't help it.
There you go. That's great. We're talking to Carol Burnett, everyone. Her new book, This Time Together. It's great. Carol, I can't believe the time's gone so fast. One final question before I let you go. You've written this book, and I think this is your best book.
Thank you.
How do you want to be remembered?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's kind of, we made people laugh and feel better even for a moment. And
well,
I get that when I do my Q&As, people will raise their hand and say, you know, I was growing up and we watched your show and it was appointment television.
Yes.
With my family. It was the time I remember the most when we would all just say, okay, it's time for that show. Let's all get into the living room and watch it together.
Yeah, and I think that's the way most of us will remember your show, without doubt. A piece of television history. You, yourself, are a television legend. We're talking to Carol Burnett, her new book, This Time Together, Laughter and Reflection. Carol, it's great. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you.
Once again, you are tuned to a special 4th of July weekend encore presentation of Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. Let's get to Billy's next guest.
We like to recognize celebrities when they come into Ventura County, and today we've got a celebrity suspense writer who's visiting the county to do a book signing. Jeff Deaver was born outside of Chicago. I won't tell you the year. He can do that if he likes himself. He wrote his first book, which was two chapters long, when he was 11 years old, and he has been writing ever since. He got his Bachelor of Journalism degree from the University of Missouri, go Tigers, and then you became a writer, and ultimately you had this crazy notion you wanted to go back to law school, so you enrolled at Fordham Law School, got your law degree there, and fortunately I think you came to your senses, you started writing novels, and to date you've done 22 different novels, including your latest one, which you're going to be talking about today. And your books have been translated into 35 different languages and have been translated onto the screen. Most notably, your book, The Bone Collector, was starring Denzel Washington, was released by Universal Pictures, another of your Lincoln Rhyme books that are out there. So welcome to the show, Jeffrey Deaver. How are you?
Thank you so much. I'm humbled hearing all that. I'm also exhausted. I didn't know I'd done so much.
You are a man of many talents, and we want to get them out there. I know that your time is precious because you are on your way to that book signing, but tell us about your latest book, The Burning Wire.
Well, this is the ninth in the series that stars, I guess I would say, Lincoln Rhyme, the character that your listeners may know from The Bone Collector. And I love my villains. Villains are actually my favorite characters in the books. And this villain is a fellow who gets into the New York City power grid, but he doesn't do what sort of the cliche that you'd see in a bad made-for-TV movie. He doesn't shut it down. He does the opposite. He revs it up so that, well, frankly, people get electrocuted when they're walking down the street. They touch a doorknob. They reach for one of those little push buttons to change the light, and zap, that's it. And Lincoln and Amelia, the characters from the Bone Collector and about eight other books, get on the case. And it's a typical Jeffrey Deaver. It's really a cat-and-mouse chase. Takes place over a couple days, moves really quickly. People's palms sweat, and I think I have to say it's a pretty good read.
Well, I have not read it yet. I'm waiting for the copy from your publicist, but I will say your past books are great. I like Lincoln Rhymes because he's flawed, and I can relate more to him than I can to some of the other fictional heroes that are out there as well. And I think that the combination of Rhymes and Sachs is a good combination for you as well. Tell me, I know we've only got a couple of minutes. You're going to do this book signing over at Mysteries to Die For in Thousand Oaks.
Yeah.
Tell me, in your opinion, why do local independent bookstores matter?
Oh, local independent bookstores are the backbone of the business. I say that this for two reasons. One, out of a great deal of loyalty, because I write a book that is, you know, it's a little bit different. They take place over a really short not traditionally what you'd think of as your classic murder mystery. I got the juices going really fast. It's been the hand-selling of independent bookstores going back, I've been doing this for about 30 years now, that really built my audience. And now that audience is, you know, 4 or 5 million people around the world, and I have the independents to thank for getting me going. But most important, they're the conduit to get the stories into the hands of folks in little communities around around the world. That's just what's important about them.
Just like here in Ventura County. I think well said, very well said. We're talking to Jeffrey Deaver, everybody. His latest book is The Burning Wire. It is a great read for you at the beach this summer, so you may want to pick it up, say, have some little beach reading. I want to ask you a serious question, if I can, Jeffrey. I want to come back to your premise about The Burning Wire and taking hostage the whole electrical grid in New York. You know, and the question is this, that Tom Clancy wrote a novel many years ago where a jet plane crashes into a building, killing everybody inside.
Sure, right.
Several years later, we had 9/11. You know, what effect do you think stunning plots like yours and like Tom Clancy's have on influencing would-be criminals or would-be terrorists?
Oh, sure. I'm very cognizant of that responsibility. And that's one of the reasons that my villains are really, I guess I call them super villains. What happens in the book, although it's credible in the sense that I weave a believable spell, I like to think, couldn't really happen. I mean, you could sit down with my book and there's no way in the world you could actually do anything to the grid. But what I do is suspend disbelief so that my my readers say, wow, you know, that's scary. I think that could actually happen. And then they're going to think twice about maybe pushing that button to cross the street. Well, it couldn't really happen. And I'll say another thing that I'm very aware of. Young people reading the books. My readers go down to like 13 or 14.
Sure.
And I know they're, you know, I remember when I was 13 and 14, I was a bit impressionable, a little impulsive. So I'm very cautious about, you know, kind of generating that testosterone among the kids and so forth. I keep the violence off camera. I kind of adhere to Alfred Hitchcock's theory, which was suspense is better than gore. So my books, they you know, on the surface, they may be appear to be a bit violent. Actually, it's more suspense. We don't see anything gruesome. No kids are hurt, no children, no animals. None of that happens.
Oh, I love it. I love it. An author who relies on suspense and leaves all of the blood and guts to your imagination,
well,
which is probably
those,
scarier.
I have to say, Bill, I saw one of those Saw movies. Well, I got about halfway through it, and I said, oh, this is just icky. I don't care for this.
I see. Yeah, I don't blame you. I don't blame you at all. Now, you're on your way to the book signing over at Mysteries to Die For. Mm-hmm. Where can our listeners learn more about you and about some of the books that you've written?
Well, you can certainly go to jeffreydeaver.com, my website, and you'll learn a bunch of interesting stuff. For instance, I'm in the midst of writing the new James Bond novel for
next
year.
Are you? You're going to take over the role of Ian Fleming?
I sure am. I've been in talks with the wonderful Ian Fleming estate for the last 6 months or so, and we finally decided to go ahead and do it, and that book will be out next year. We don't have a title for it yet, but it's kind of a fun project because you mentioned that little book I wrote many, many years ago.
Yes.
I was about 11 years old.
Yes.
Well, that was sort of an homage to James Bond. I think my hero was probably called Fred Bond or something like that.
Something very similar.
He was a spy from probably in Washington, D.C. But we've been talking to the estate, and I'm in the midst of the book now, so your listeners can go to jeffreydeaver.com and learn more about that.
Well, now that's breaking news. So you're going to be the next James Bond writer taking over for Ian Fleming. How
I am,
cool.
And I keep waiting for the phone calls from Aston Martin and Bentley saying, you know, Mr. Deaver, I think you need to try out the new car, but that hasn't happened yet.
They will come, believe me, they
waiting.
Will come. great. We've been talking to Jeffrey Deaver, everybody. He is an author who has just written a new book, The Burning Wire. It is a great summer read if you take it with you to the beach, get some sun, get some entertainment as well.
You are tuned to a special encore presentation for the 4th of July weekend, Brainstorming with Billy the Brain on AM 1400 KKZZ. Now let's get back to Billy the Brain and his next interview. Happy 4th of July, everyone, from all of us here at AM 1400 KKZZ. Now let's get back to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain.
The theme today is heroes, both real and imagined. And our next guest is absolutely one of my most favorite heroes. He's been a hero in many of his acting roles. He is best known as Reverend Eric Camden in the long-running series Seventh Heaven, which, by the way, was the longest-running series ever on the WB Network. I did not know that. The WB Network promoted the WB as the longest-running family drama series in television history, also the longest-running show produced by Aaron Spelling. I first became aware of our next guest as Jake Cutter in Tales of the Gold Monkey, which was one of my absolute favorites, and we're going to ask him about that. His television and movie credits are impressive. In addition to the aforementioned Seventh Heaven and Tales of the Gold Monkey, he's been in Spamalot on Broadway, where he was King Arthur, Star Trek, the motion picture, Brewster's Millions, Jumpin' Jack Flash, The Two Mrs. Grenvilles, adapted from the book by the same name, The First Wife's Club, Blood Diamond, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Barnaby Jones, and The Waltons. In addition to being a first-rate actor, he's also a director and a novelist. Stephen Collins was born in Des Moines, Iowa, which probably accounts for his everyman good looks and believability as an actor. He graduated cum laude from Amherst College in Massachusetts. And Stephen, I must tell you that Billy the Brain wanted to go to Amherst. That was his first choice in college, but didn't make it in. Probably you were taking my seat there.
Yeah.
Let's see. You acted in television, movies, and on Broadway. You're married to actress Faye Grant.
Yep.
And not as many, many people believe, to the lovely actress that you played. You played your wife on the show, Catherine Hicks. You guys had great chemistry on that show, but you are, in fact, not married in real life. You also are an author of two novels, Eye Contact and Double Exposure. And I want to ask you about those, too. So,
sure.
Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. Wow, what an intro.
Well, what an actor. What an honor to have you on the show. Well, let's just start at the beginning, Stephen. How did you first get the acting bug?
I think it's a gene or a chromosome. I can remember being very little, like 4 or 5 years old. It's one of my earliest memories, and someone saying, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And I said, and mumbling, not loud enough to be heard, I said, "I want to be a movie star."
Wow.
And they said, "What?" And I didn't even repeat it, because I thought to myself, "Where did that come from? You know, what are you talking about?" You know, it is a strange thing. The acting bug, I think, is like planted in there without our knowing it. And so it's really hard to know. I don't come from an acting family. I had a couple of. I remember once reading that Sir Laurence Olivier, the great actor, had grandparents.
Yes.
Who were both performers, amateur mm-hmm. performers, and I did too. Actually, both my grandfathers were sort of amateur song and dance men. So sometimes I wonder if it skips a generation.
There you go. That's exactly right. You look at your own role models, and your grandparents or your grandfathers were your role model. That is great. All right. Now, you went to Amherst, as I said before, was my first choice for college. Didn't get in.
I'll bet your father didn't go there.
You're darned right.
See, my father and grandfather did, and Amherst is a very tough school to get into, but it helps a little if you're a legacy.
Yeah, legacy always helps. But what a wonderful school. And how did Amherst sort of shape not only your personal philosophy, but your acting philosophy as well?
Boy, that's, you know, it's funny. Nobody ever asks that, and it Amherst had a lot to do with what was great. For me, about Amherst was, for those who don't know it, it's a small liberal arts college in Massachusetts. It's always ranked number one or number two small college in the country. It's an amazing place, but it's not a place that people traditionally go to for acting. When I got there, I didn't know that I was going to be an actor. I thought I'd probably go to law school. But there was a thriving little theater department that just did tons of plays.
Mm-hmm.
I did 22 plays there, lead roles, as an undergraduate.
Wow.
All between the middle of my sophomore year and I was so intimidated by all the guys who were sure they were going to be professional actors my freshman year that I didn't even try out for a play.
Wow.
And none of those guys, by the way, became an actor.
Yeah, I was going to ask that.
So I always tell, you know, when young people who are considering college and they want to be an actor or performer say, "Where should I go?" I always say, go to a small college that has a theater department. My advice is, unless you're stupendously talented, you might want to think twice about going to a big place like NYU or Northwestern, where there are going to be hundreds and hundreds of people trying to get those 4 or 5 great roles. Because really, all that matters when you're in school is that you act. It doesn't matter, and if you're playing a great role, you're going to learn so much. And it doesn't matter whether you're playing at Podunk U or at Northwestern or at Amherst. It really doesn't. Mm. It matters that you go through that process. So by the time I got out of college, I felt completely incorrectly, by the way, that I was like one of the best actors on earth. And it gave me this, because I had done 22 plays. You know, I'd made audiences laugh, and I'd made them cry, and I knew how to hold an audience's attention, and you kind of only get that by doing it.
Right.
And as somebody told me later, he said, you know, it was a good choice. Going to Amherst was a good choice because you got to do all those plays. If you'd gone somewhere else, you might have only gotten to do two or three, and you wouldn't have learned anywhere near as much.
Well, that's a very good point. We're talking to Stephen Collins, everybody, and just what a great, great guy he is to talk to us today. Let me ask you about summer stock, because Massachusetts and is known for summer stock up there. Were you participating in that when you weren't in school at Amherst?
No, there's a famous summer theater at Williamstown. It's funny because it's on the campus of Williams College, which happens to be Amherst's arch rival.
Yeah.
And I never worked there as an undergraduate. It was really too hard to get into, because the Williamstown Theater Festival, which operates in the summer and is just a fantastic place to see theater, kind of gets the creme de la creme from New York, actors, directors, writers, designers, because they can all go up there and do a play in from beginning to end in about 4 weeks. And it's close enough to Manhattan that, you know, the New York Times comes usually once a summer and reviews things. And the community, it truly is like summer camp for grown-ups.
Summer camp for actors. I love it.
Greatest place.
Oh, it absolutely is. Stephen, our special guest, everybody, is Stephen Collins. We're talking to him. He's in some secure bunker down in greater Los Angeles. We're not exactly sure. I would be absolutely stoned if I went home tonight. My wife would kill me if I didn't ask you about your role as Jake Cutter in Tales of the Gold Monkey. That is absolutely when I first realized that you were an actor, and a huge break for you. What was that like? Tell us about that role.
Oh, boy. It was 1982, and I guess I had just made the decision to do a television series, and I heard about this show. Donald Belisario, who later did
Magnum,
and he did Quantum Leap, and he created NCIS and all sorts of other things on TV, had written this big, old-fashioned action-adventure show. And I was offered it, and I read the script, and I just said yes immediately. And by the way, and I think this may be a coincidence, Tales of the Gold Monkey has just this week come out finally on DVD.
Oh, good. That was one of my questions.
Yes.
So this week it's available.
It's available on Amazon and wherever else DVDs are sold. But it's a terrific set. It's the whole series. We were only on 1 year. For those who don't know about it, it was a big... It took place in 1938 on a fictitious island in the South Pacific called Bora-Gora. And the great, dear departed Roddy McDowall was on the show, and a wonderful, also dear departed fellow named Jeff McKay, who played my sidekick, Corky, and
yes.
And Caitlin O'Heaney, a wonderful actress who played the girl on the show. It's funny about Gold Monkey. Don Belisario, who created it, tried to sell it to the networks about 2 years earlier, and they all passed on it.
They did?
And then Raiders of the Lost Ark came out.
And kaboom.
And the network suddenly called Donald and said, you know, remember that show you pitched about the guy who... Because I played a guy who flew a two-bit amphibious plane for hire. And suddenly the whole South Pacific 1938 action-adventure thing seemed very, very good. But a lot of people thought that Tales of the Gold Monkey was kind of ripping off Raiders, but in fact it was pitched before Raiders ever came out.
It preceded Raiders by a couple of years.
Yeah.
That's incredible. That really is. Yeah. Now, that for me was a great role. That introduced me to you as an actor. I subsequently saw you in a bunch of other things. I mean, your credits are just incredible. There was Star Trek, Jumpin' Jack Flash, The Two Mrs. Grenvilles, First Wife's Club, more recently Blood Diamond. But the role that you're probably best known for is Eric Camden on Seventh Heaven.
Yeah.
How did you land that role, and what was the best part of being Eric Camden?
You know, I landed the role. It's funny. I was in Los Angeles spending 1 year in L.A. I did the final season of a series called Sisters. I did a storyline with Celia Ward, which was just great, great fun. And my daughter was 5. And so we rented a house in L.A. for that year. She did kindergarten out here. And about 3 days after we finished shooting, We were getting set to go on a little family vacation for a few days, just a long weekend, really. And my daughter still had about a month of kindergarten left, and then we were going back to New York. And I get this phone call from my manager who said, she said, you're about to get offered a series, but I'm pretty sure you're not going to want to do it. And I said, really, why? And she said, well, it's on this new WB network. Nobody's watching it. And it's an Aaron Spelling show, so it'll probably be kind of all tinsel. And then The Kiss of Death, she said, and it's a family show.
So it was a triple threat.
Yeah, and I said, well, let me read it. She said, well, they haven't made the formal offer yet, but I think they're about to. So she called back and said, all right, they've made the offer. And they literally faxed. I said, look, we're trying to get out of town, and if I stick around and wait for the script to arrive and read it, we're never going to get out of here. We're going up to Ojai for the weekend.
Oh.
So I said, we're just going to go, and maybe they can fax it. And it's interesting. This is 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The fax machine at the Ojai Valley Inn, a wonderful place,
yes,
still did, you know, curly papered faxes. So when I arrived there, they had this thing that looked like a wild animal, like a shaggy, you know, woolly behemoth of papers flying around in all directions because the old fax paper wouldn't lie flat.
Yeah. Oh, that's.
And I went up to my room and read it, and it was a no brainer. It was like Tales of the Gold Monkey. And Aaron Spelling called me that night, and he said, look, the only catch is we start shooting. It was Wednesday now at about 5:30 p.m.
Uh-huh.
And he said, we start shooting Friday morning at 6.
Oh, my gosh. So you had to hightail it down from Ojai to the
studio?
I had to
hightail it back. My wife and daughter stayed up there. And you know, as you said, it actually, my favorite credit for Seventh Heaven is it was the longest running family drama in network TV history.
Yeah, it's an incredible. I mean,
it lasted longer than The Waltons and Little House.
Yes, amazing. It really is. It, in fact, so many things about it were good. Every story had a theme or a moral to it, and you really tackled some very difficult issues. I remember one, perhaps the best watched episode was when the birth of Lucy's daughter.
Yeah.
And that was hugely watched and, you know, obviously not controversial, but certainly tackling a big issue. Were you aware, you and the director sit down and talk about the moral of the story, or did it just sort of happen based
on
the script?
We didn't really have to, because everything, anyone who works as an actor knows, it all comes from the script. And Brenda Hampton, who created Seventh Heaven, she was the voice of that show. She was the showrunner and executive producer all 11 seasons.
Mm.
And it was completely her baby.
Wow.
And it was the best thing for an actor because she wrote it and we acted it. She didn't seek a lot of feedback from us because she didn't need to. She understood the voice of that show. And she knew, and you mentioned this, the chemistry. The cast had this remarkable chemistry, which is just good luck.
Yeah, you did, no doubt about it.
When we read the script, we got together to do a script read-through of the pilot the day before we started shooting. And Duke Vincent, who was Aaron Spelling's partner for decades, was there at the read-through, and he said, I've never seen a cast gel like this. It's like you guys have all known each other all your lives.
Wow.
And that was just luck, you know, Jessica Biel and Beverly Mitchell and Barry Watson, David Gallagher and Catherine and I, who just, I don't know, that's just dumb luck.
Well, let's drill down on that, because the chemistry definitely was there. By the way, we're talking to Stephen Collins, everybody, actor, been on a number of things, but we're focusing right now on Seventh Heaven, the longest-running family drama in television history. You were paired with Catherine Hicks. She's also an ex-Star Trek alumnus,
yeah.
as it happens, but you guys were such a believable couple. I mean, to this day, I bet you get approached by people who ask you about Catherine as your wife.
Oh, yeah, people ask about all of us. They say, where are the kids? You know, like And I love, it shows how much they believed in the Camden family, you know. It was, Catherine and I, it's funny about acting chemistry. I don't know where it comes from. The other thing that was interesting, aside from the fact that we were both alumni of Star Trek movies, and I fully concede that hers was, I think, the better movie.
You like that movie better?
I just think it was more fun.
I was
in the first Star Trek movie, and it took itself awfully seriously.
Yes.
But, you know, it still has, the first movie still has great stuff, but I think hers is just a terrific all-around romp. But the other thing that was interesting about our casting, and again, nobody asked us this in the casting process. I mean, I was offered the thing out of a blue moon, is that we were both churchgoers.
Mm-hmm.
And Catherine was raised Catholic. I was raised Episcopal. And, you know, it's interesting if you cast husband and wife for that show to get, as I say, nobody said, by the way, do you go to church? Do you believe in God? How would you feel about playing a minister? Yeah, it was just, again, more, you know, makes, I was going to say dumb luck, but it does make me feel that there's an invisible hand sometimes guiding things.
Yeah, well said. I would have to agree with that. And you guys were just spectacular together. Now, in the show, you lived in a fictitious town called Glen Oaks, California.
Right.
Of course, we know that no such place exists. But as you were doing this, in your mind's eye, did you pick a particular city in California to sort of model Glen Oaks after?
I think we shot the pilot at a big house up in Altadena, and that house and the whole community of Altadena felt a lot like what I, you know, it just felt right. We then, of course, built a little tiny, Seventh Heaven was shot in a little makeshift studio in Santa Monica,
mm-hmm.
All by itself on the lot of what used to be a shower door factory. Aaron Spelling had converted it into a little studio years before, and it had laid vacant for years.
Mm.
And that was our world. You know, there was no one else on that little lot, just the Seventh Heaven family. And little by little, they built what we call the Glen Oak Promenade, which is an outdoor street, you know, the main pedestrian business thoroughfare in Glen Oak. And we built a backyard set for the house. And we shot, you know, all but in a seven-day shoot, we might shoot one or two days off a lot, but the great majority of shows were shot entirely on that little lot.
Wow.
And so I think, for me, Glen Oak kind of appears in my head. I think I think of it a little bit like, do you know the Saroyan book? There's a wonderful book by William Saroyan called The Human Comedy.
Mm.
And it takes place farther north in California, but it kind of conjures up a perfect little American small town, which I guess I think Glen Oak was supposed to be.
And that's the way it was depicted, for sure. Yeah. Good. We're talking to Stephen Collins, everybody. Let's shift gears. We've only got a couple of minutes left, Stephen. It just goes by so fast. But in addition to television and the movies, you are also on the boardwalk at Broadway. I'm just amazed at that. You played Arthur, King Arthur, in Spamalot.
Yeah,
one of my favorite.
Before last.
Yeah. And what was that experience like for you? And a big departure for you from television to movies, isn't it?
Well, I started, you know, in the theaters. We were talking at the beginning. I spent my first 6 years as a professional actor in New York, doing plays on and off Broadway, and then and I've done a few in between. But the chance to do Spamalot I got a call one day a couple of years ago. Would you like to fly into New York and audition for Mike Nichols to do Spamalot? Like, when's the next flight?
Right. Oh, how fun!
And so that was a dream come true. I'd always wanted. I think I started loving acting. Because my parents, I grew up just outside Manhattan, and my parents went to the theater all the time. When they loved a show, they'd buy the cast album. And
mm-hmm.
I grew up listening to cast albums of Broadway musicals, many of which I didn't see, but I knew them intimately because my parents played them all the time.
And what was your favorite Broadway musical growing up?
Unquestionably, Damn Yankees.
Really?
Yeah, because I'm a baseball fan.
Right.
And the score of that, Damn Yankees is one of the great Broadway scores of all time,
right.
Adler and Ross. Unfortunately, one of them died young, and so they only wrote Damn Yankees, and they wrote The Pajama Game, and that was it.
Yeah, but you talk about two successful plays,
two great
plays.
Shows. So when Spamalot came along and the opportunity to work with Mike Nichols, I just jumped, and it was an amazing experience, just fantastic.
Wow, did you have to take voice lessons or anything, or are you just naturally a good singer in the shower?
You know, I've kept my voice up, particularly in the last 5 or 6 years, because I have a bar band, a rock and roll band I play with on the side. And when I exercise, I have an elliptical machine in the garage, and I have an iPod playlist of songs that I love to sing. So I do the elliptical and I sing at the top of my lungs, and it sort of has kept my voice fresh. I always do work with a vocal coach, but fortunately the score of Spamalot was just right in my wheelhouse vocal range.
Oh, that's great.
It wasn't a strain at all.
That is great. We're talking, everybody, to Stephen Collins, accomplished actor, television, Broadway, movies. But the thing that intrigued me the most as I was doing some research, Stephen, was you're an accomplished author as well. You've written two novels.
Yeah.
I mean, and first of all, Eye Contact and Double Exposure, the two novels. Eye Contact, I thought, dealt with some pretty dark and provocative stuff. But both of your novels had very self-absorbed main characters. So I got to ask you, where did that come from?
Oh, gosh. You know, writing fiction is such a strange kind of self-Rorschach test. I never know what I'm going to write about until it literally just comes out. I really didn't plan Eye Contact, and I think that the lead character, who is a person with a very interesting, dark life, and it's a woman,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, I don't know where it comes from. It's like you throw all of your experience in. There's a little of me in there. There's a little of me in all the characters. What I love about writing fiction, somebody once said, if you want to read the truth, read fiction. If you want to read something made up, read nonfiction.
I've never heard that. That's good.
Well, I think people like to rewrite the story of their lives sometimes when they tell their autobiography.
Mm.
Fiction's a way of sort of taking bits and pieces of your reality and moving them around into other characters. And I needed something between work, between jobs as an actor, to keep me from worrying about the phone ringing. And years ago, I did a movie in Europe called Fedora with Billy Wilder, and William Holden was in it.
He
gave me that advice. He said to me, you've got to have something outside of acting that you love to do. And for me, it became writing. And of course, and the only downside to Seventh Heaven running all those years was that I had always thought that I would spend this last part of my life writing novels. And so I hope to do it again. It's been like 14 years since the last one came out, and I'd love to write another one. But by the way, and I wish I could tell you the title, I'm in negotiations now to do another TV series.
Oh, you are? Oh, great.
I can't say what it is.
Right, you did. You could tell us, but you'd have to kill us, sort of thing.
And if we did this interview tomorrow, I might be able to say it, but it's one of the new fall shows that's on the air. I also want to, if I can, because
sure.
I'll be, when it's set, I'll be tweeting about it. I'm on Twitter at, someone took Stephen Collins, how dare they. So my Twitter name is _ Stephen Collins.
_ Stephen
There's
Collins.
One space, just an underline and then STEPHEN.
All right.
LLINS.
So you're going to get a
tweeting about it, but unfortunately the deal isn't signed and sealed yet.
Well, I hope you'll come back on when it is signed and done. We're talking to Stephen Collins, everybody. And if you want to tweet him, it's _ Stephen Collins.
Right.
And that will get you in touch with him, and you'll be the first to know when he lands his new series. We've only got about a minute left, Stephen, but let's get to know a little bit more about you as the person. We've heard that you like to play, you play music in a rock band. You're obviously a novelist. You like writing and so forth. I wanted to ask you, to whom are you most grateful for in your life, and did you ever get a chance to tell that person how grateful you were?
I'd say it's a toss-up in different ways between my grandmother, my mother's mother, who was a wonderful artist, and I spent all my summers with her, and my parents, who were great providers. Without my dad, I don't think I would have known about Amherst College, and I wouldn't have gone there, and that was so huge in my development as a person, as an actor. A great teacher there named Kim Townsend, who's still in the English department at Amherst, and my wife. I'd go with my wife, Faye Grant, who was the first person in my life who I think had the nerve to tell me that I needed to go to an acting class.
Leave it to a wife to
be brutally honest. She was a guest star on Tales of the Gold Monkey, which we were talking about earlier, and she said, you could be so much better. And I was working so much that I don't think anyone had the nerve to say that to me, but she was right, and I started doing that, and that's when I really started to enjoy acting.
Wow, that is great. Everybody, we're talking to Stephen Collins. He mentioned that Tales of Gold Monkey is coming out on DVD this week.
It is out now.
It is out.
Yep, you can get it at Amazon.
All right. Go to Amazon or any place else that DVDs are sold, and you'll be able to find it there. Stephen, thank you so much for this time. I'm grateful to you for that.
Really, thank you. It's a real pleasure.
Oh, enjoyed it so much. Thanks. Take care. We'll talk to you down the road.
Okay, I hope so.
Take care now.
And thank you so much for tuning in to this special 4th of July weekend encore presentation of Brainstorming with Billy the Brain on Positive Talk Radio, AM 1400, KKZZ. Billy interviews the best of the best every Monday through Friday from 10 to 11 in sports, entertainment, politics, and economics. And remember, local interviews too. Living Your Inspired Life with Susan Burrell is coming up next. Happy 4th of July, everyone, from all of us here on AM 1400 KKZZ.